Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Maxwell's House is brought to you by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Maxwell's House with Ray Maxwell and Dr. Kiki Sanford, episode number 75, The Density of Hot Air.
This episode of Maxwell's House is brought to you by Audible.com. For your free audiobook download, go to audiblepodcast.com/house. Welcome, everyone, to Maxwell's House. This is the show that's full of flight, levity. Today, a bunch of hot air. I'm Dr. Kiki. It's episode 75. We're talking about the density of hot air with Ray Maxwell.
Hi there. How are you doing? I think everybody in the chat room is saying, hey, this show's full of hot air every week. So what's new?
I'm sure there will be a lot new on today's show. I was looking at your show notes, and I'm really excited to find out all about hot air balloons, right? Is that what we're covering
today?
That's
right. We're going to cover a little news and answer a few questions, and then we're going to talk about the density of hot air and what that has to do with flying hot air balloons. But before I get into that topic in the news today, it is my sad duty to report the passing of a good friend of mine, Jeannie Robinson. Jeannie is a science fiction author, choreographer, dancer, and she was shortlisted to be an artist in space before the Challenger accident.
Oh, wow.
Because she and her husband, a well-known science fiction writer, Spider Robinson, co-wrote a trilogy. The first of the trilogy was Star Dancer, and then there was Star Mind and Star Seed. And Jeannie, before her passing, was working on a movie script based on Star Dancer, and that work is still continuing. And with luck, we hope that will come to pass. But unfortunately, last Sunday, she passed away and in a protracted battle with cancer. And our condolences go out to Spider, another good friend, and her entire family and group of friends here in the Vancouver area.
Yeah, so, definitely. I'm sorry to hear about that.
Yeah, she was a very, very special lady. I could literally spend the show telling you stories and special events having to do with Jeannie. She is a very, very special, very neat person. And, she dreamed of dancing weightlessly in space. Mm. And that's what Star Dancer is all about. And luckily, about 6 months to a year ago, I guess it's been a year ago, there was a special arrangement, and she got to go up in the Vomit Comet, the aircraft that NASA uses, and actually do some video with a dancer that she had done the choreography with. And they got to dance in weightlessness. So she did get to do that before her passing. At any rate, I will move on now in the more recent news. And my next item in the news, I want to report a typical reporting of media of aviation incidents and how when they report on aviation incidents, they don't do enough research. Recently, again, sadly, we had an accident here on the west coast of Vancouver Island involving a pilot and three young people that crashed in a float plane. They still don't know exactly how this happened, But the misinformation that went around was immediately the media jumped on the fact that, these people's lives could have been saved if they were only wearing life jackets.
Mm-hmm.
And they jumped on the fact that the National Transportation Safety Board or the had suggested that it be required that people wear life jackets when flying in a float plane. And unfortunately, it's not that simple. You know, this is one of those cases where you have to understand more of the facts and you have to do some in-depth reporting and understand why this might actually create a hazard in float planes rather than a life-saving effort. If you wore a standard life jacket, like the type that are on board boats that provide flotation, and you were in a float plane that flipped or went underwater, you would be pinned by that flotation to the top of the cabin of the aircraft. And to get out, you would have to swim down strenuously to an opening in the aircraft in order to get out. And so if you're wearing a conventional life jacket, it's actually dangerous in a float plane.
Hmm.
What you may have noticed when you get on board a commercial airliner and they're flying over water is they point out to you that there is an inflatable life jacket under your seat. And right. In the briefing, they go into great length to tell you, do not inflate this life jacket on board the aircraft. Wait till you are clear of the aircraft to inflate it. Because once again, if you end up underwater, that inflated life jacket would pin you inside the aircraft. And the big question on float planes is, in a panic, would people pull, you know, if they ended up underwater, would they pull and inflate the life jacket and pin themselves? And would they pin themselves in such a way that they would block other people in the aircraft getting out of the plane? So it's not, you know, at first it sounds like, well, it's an obvious thing. Everybody ought to wear life jackets, but it's not that easy. You know, so the operators of float planes have good reason to say, well, yes, we think they ought to be on board and available. But you have to do a very careful briefing with people and hope they don't panic if they suddenly find themselves underwater. So, anyway, one of those things that isn't that black and white.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it seems like the way you're discussing it, that it's fairly logical when it comes down to it. You have an inflatable life jacket so that you can get out should you be able to, and then you inflate it and you're able to float on the surface of the water. And that seems to be the most logical answer there.
Right. But the media in reporting this, nobody mentioned anything about inflatable or non-inflatable. You know what I'm saying? It was just, well, it's obvious. Everybody ought to wear life jackets.
Well, of course, that's the way it should be. Yeah.
You know. And you know,
all of the things that go into a particular decision and why people are not. It's not like it's a motorboat or a water maggot or whatever.
Right, precisely. So, at any rate, I just found that interesting this week, and then one of our fans wrote in and pointed me to a wonderful site that I really got a bang out of. And I call it Waco Glass Cockpits. Now, the Waco or Waco depends on who you ask how to pronounce that, but was an aircraft that was built back in the 30s or 40s and was a biplane, very popular back then. And there's a couple of pictures at www.wacoclassic.com. That's W-A-C-O classic.com. And if you click into it, you can get into a full screen view of the cockpits of these aircraft. If you just scroll down on that page and look for 360-degree view, And after it loads, you can navigate around the cockpit. If you take your cursor, you can look around. And someone has installed a fully modern glass cockpit in this 1930s biplane. You can see the wings out there. It's just wonderful. And I couldn't believe it. This is a super sophisticated glass cockpit inside a antique airplane. So what a combination. At any rate, it's well worth having a look at. I think you'll find it very, very enjoyable. And
from the look at it, it's just beautiful quality, and it's got all the details. I mean, right now I'm scrolling around and looking at the harness on the seat, and then as we turn further, we can see the controls for. I don't know what those are. Those look like radio. You put your headphones in.
Those are circuit breakers.
Circuit breakers. And
I'm going to the left.
And then
though.
Certificates saying that this plane is okay to fly.
Right. But look at the electronic glass cockpit there with the moving map display and everything. It's, you know, these are the latest and greatest avionics in this antique airplane.
It's
it just has a beautiful, beautiful instrument panel there. It's just great.
What a fun tour. What a fun website to find. This is neat.
Yeah. You can tour around. It's like you're sitting in the pilot seat of the aircraft. Fantastic.
So have you flown a biplane like this before?
The only biplane I've flown was a Kristen Eagle, which is a modern, high-performance aerobatic biplane. I have always wanted to fly a real open cockpit. Specifically, I want to go up and fly a Stearman open cockpit before I pass from this earth, because I would love to do aerobatics in a plane of that type. And I've never gotten to have the chance. I've gone to places that had them where they gave rides. But in both cases, the pilots were not qualified to let me fly the airplane. In other words, they were not instructors.
Right.
And they were low-time pilots, and they didn't feel comfortable. And I said, well, the only way I'm going up is if you let me fly it. And, of course, you need someone, that if you haven't flown that aircraft before, that's very comfortable with the aircraft and comfortable with an experienced pilot flying it.
And so flying something of that, a biplane like that, or like the Stearman that you're talking about, would take additional training to what you currently have in piloting?
No, not really. I learned in tail draggers and have flown similar aircraft, so it wouldn't. But I haven't flown that specific type, and I, of course, would want a qualified instructor, someone that was very comfortable with that aircraft to go along with me, because not only would I want to fly it, but I would want to do some aerobatics, and so I need someone trained in aerobatic instruction.
Okay.
And so far, I haven't encountered the airplane with a qualified pilot. You know.
Well, you put it out there. Maybe somebody who knows somebody can get you in touch with an acrobatics Stearman pilot.
That's what I'm after.
There you go, people.
I'd love to do it.
Make it happen.
Yeah. Somebody in the Northwest has got. There are some around, and I'm going to try and find one and trade aerobatic glider flights or something with the guy. Yeah. All right. Now the other piece of news that I found quite amusing was a man crosses the English Channel under a cluster of helium balloons, just like in the movie Up.
What? I thought this was,
yes, you know the guy with a bunch of helium balloons over a chair. A guy actually did this and crossed the English Channel, and just like the cartoon. So I think that's fantastic.
And did he just, do you know if he just followed the air currents took him across, and that was, he just planned it on that?
Yeah, he launched from the downwind, you know, I think he launched from the Great Britain side, the prevailing winds are from the west. And went over and landed in Europe there, and I think he did it following all the rules and regulations. I haven't heard any screams or anything.
Are there rules and regulations to flying in a chair with helium balloons?
Yes. I mean, if you're going to want to talk to air traffic control, And hopefully you would be licensed to fly helium balloons. There are, you know, but usually they aren't a cluster of colored weather balloons and hang suspended to a chair. But there are, you know, you can go to the, you know, the air traffic control and the air regulating people. And I'm sure you can sit down and work out a plan by where you could do that sort of thing. If you put out the proper notices and so forth and fly in the proper airspace, et cetera, that it's possible to do. And I didn't see any howls of objection to him doing it. So I assume he did it by the rules, but I don't know that. I mean, he may have broke every rule in the book. But there was a guy in California who did it, and he did indeed break every rule in the book because he didn't notify anybody he was going to do it. And he went up into controlled airspace and some airliners saw him float by and were not too happy that he was in that airspace. So there you go.
Wow. That's just amazing.
Yeah.
So note to self, next time I decide to take my take my lawn chair up into the airspace, make sure I notify the proper authorities.
That's
I'm
right.
Going to contact you to make sure that I've contacted all the right people.
There you go.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, my. Now, I got some questions in the mail from our viewers. And one of them wrote in and he said, I've heard that land surveyors can get very high accuracy from GPS, much higher than pilots and boats and so forth. So how is this possible? And it is true. What they do is they mount a special. It's not a normal GPS receiver. It's a special GPS receiver, and they mount it on a tripod, and they do this over what's called a baseline. They have two of these systems, and what they want to know is how far apart these two tripods are from each other. And so they mount these two special units, and they can be, I'll just give you an example, they can be 100 kilometers apart, and they can achieve accuracies of measuring that baseline to a few centimeters. So the question is, how do they do this? Because if you use the conventional GPS signals, even the military ones, you can't get that kind of accuracy. And the way they do it is they don't pay any attention at all to the encrypted signals or what have you. They simply measure the carrier waves from all these different satellites, and they measure the Doppler shift of these signals as the satellites are moving overhead. And of course, as they're moving in their orbits, the Doppler shift changes. And the one thing that you have to understand to get this kind of accuracy, they have to leave these two tripods in position for something like an hour or two. So this method is not good for navigating airplanes because you're moving all the time at high speed. So to get this kind of accuracy, you have to leave the GPS receiving station in one place on the Earth, absolutely stationary for an hour or two. And if you do that, then by measuring the carrier wave signal and the Doppler shift in it, you can go through a set of calculations and very accurately pinpoint the distance between your two stations by comparing the differences in the signals and so forth between the two signals received at these two different places. So it is an amazingly, they use it for getting extremely high accuracy in surveying. So that's how they do it. Now, the, I thought this was a fascinating question, and Kristen, jump in on this and tell me what you think of this.
Yeah.
You know, last week, I have to report some errata, an error, a gross error made last week. I talked about the Gimli glider, this airliner that ran out of fuel,
right,
and landed on the drag strip that was a former airport. And I moved Gimli, Manitoba, to Gimli, Alberta.
Oops.
That's totally wrong. It's in the province of Manitoba. So I was out by a whole province. So any rate, but this raised an interesting question. One of our viewers wrote in and said, what are the ethics of landing an airliner on a landing strip occupied by people?
That's a really interesting question.
Yeah, it's very interesting and thought-provoking. Pardon me. The you know, question is, you've got, let's say, 200 people on board your airplane.
Yeah.
And you're coming down, and you've got this landing strip where they're holding a drag race, or there are people gathered, and there may be some people out on the strip.
Yeah.
You don't know exactly how many. And your landing there may end their lives. Now, in this actual story, no one was hurt, either on board the aircraft or, you know.
Yeah.
But what if you decided? What if you decided to land an airliner on a freeway?
Right.
Okay.
Which has happened.
Which has happened, and most of the time nobody is hurt, but you could run over a car, and you know, what are the ethics? And you know, the pure logical answer is, well, what you do, whatever damage the fewest number of people. But, you know, there's innocent people on both ends of that. And then yep. there's a pilot in between that's
making a decision. Yeah.
Making a decision and playing God. So I hope I'm never in that position.
Is this a test question on any airline pilots' certification tests?
No, I've never seen any questions like
what
this
do
one.
You choose?
Yeah, exactly. Because that is, you know, that's a very serious, very real.
Yeah,
it could happen.
Yeah,
and you know, what do you do?
Well, you have to land the plane somewhere.
That's right.
So you try and land it the safest place for everybody on board. And if, I mean, I guess you try and choose the least crowded landing area possible. So
right. Right.
Yeah.
But there may be, you know,
I don't know, every action adventure movie that I've ever seen, they just land the plane and they fly over cars and mayhem.
Right. You know? Right. But there's the real possibility that you could do damage to somebody on the ground.
Yeah.
At any rate, it's now time to pay homage to our sponsor.
Oh, yes.
Audible.com. And we really appreciate their sponsorship in bringing you this program. And I do have a pick of the week.
Great. Wonderful. We would definitely like to thank them. Audible.com is the leading provider of audiobooks with over 75,000 different titles, and they have offered a free audiobook download for people who sign up after listening to this podcast, who sign up for an account at audible.com. So you can sign up for an account at audible.com using the following address: audiblepodcast.com/house. You sign up there and you can choose any book that's in their gigantor library. You can choose books on aviation if you so choose, or you can choose books on science or periodicals even. You could download a magazine if that's what you like. They also have some podcasts on file. There's just a lot to choose from. And the great thing about audiobooks is you can really take them with you and listen to them in whatever way you choose. So you can download them to your desktop, to computer, listen to it while you work, or you can download it and then move it over to your MP3 audio playing device that you can, like your iPod, your iPhone, whatever it happens to be, and take it with you on the road. Drive with it. Listen to it wherever you want to go. So Ray has chosen a book for this week that if you sign up now at audiblepodcast.com/house, you can choose his pick of the week as your Audible download. Ray, what is it?
Well, my pick of the week this week is in memory of Jeannie Robinson. Jeannie and Spider Robinson co-wrote three books, Star Dance, Star Mind, and Star Seed, and all of those are available on Audible. So you could pick one of those if you choose, or any other title you would like and download it free from audible.com.
Great. So what are the what's the gist of the Stardance book again?
It is a science fiction tale about dancing in weightlessness. And of course, there's a lot more to the story than that, but that's where it gets its main title. And of course, there are a number of interesting characters that appear in this story. But this was co-written by Jeannie Robinson and Spider Robinson some years ago.
Great. So anybody who is interested will be able to download Stardance and the other books. If you've already read Stardance, you can download the others in the series from audible.com. And so if you go to audiblepodcast.com/house, you get that free audiobook download and you can get Stardance as that download if you so choose. Now back to the programming.
All right. Well, it brings us to our topic, the density of hot air. What's that got to do with flying hot air balloons? So first, let me tell you, a lot of people ask me, said, now look, Ray, you fly power planes, you fly float planes, you've flown small twin engine aircraft, gliders, and so forth. How on earth did you get involved with hot air balloons? So there's a story, of course. I was instructing across the line in the U.S. down at the Bayview Airport and working with a fellow by the name of Keith Allen, who I had a operation at the Bayview Airport, and he was one of these guys who did it all. He had power planes, he had gliders, and I went down to work with him to get training in doing aerobatics and gliders. And I flew with him for 5 or 6 years in a row while doing my aerobatic training. And I traded in doing normal instruction to some of his students for getting special instruction in aerobatics. And I eventually flew in air shows in a glider. And while I was there, he ended up buying a couple of hot air balloons. And he said, Ray, as well as flying the gliders and the power planes, I think it'd be appropriate if you got your rating in hot air balloons. So he said, I'll give you a special rate. And he charged me $100 per flight of the hot air balloon while I was taking lessons in flying hot air balloons from him. And by the way, that is a very special and very inexpensive rate. It doesn't even cover his costs in reality. But he was kind enough to give me that opportunity. So I would drive down to Bayview, Washington at 5 o'clock in the morning before the sun came up and before the winds came up, which is most important. And I would take hot air balloon flying lessons from Keith Allen. And we had some wonderful times. We used to I'll tell you a funny story on Keith. We at that time of the morning, there's very few people up. You know, we usually take off by 6 in the morning. And the only other aircraft that would be in the sky would be crop dusters. And so there was a crop duster that if he would see us in the sky, he'd come and circle us and kind of buzz us and waggle his wings. And Keith knew who he was and so forth. So every day he'd come up closer and closer to us and circle us and, you know, kind of fly circles around us, kind of like, you know, you poor stuck hot air balloon. And so one day, Keith couldn't resist. Keith turned backwards to him, hung a certain part of his body over the edge of the basket, and mooned the guy.
Oh, my goodness. That's hilarious.
Yeah. So I'm sure the guy will never forget that. Anyway. And now back to the serious physics of how we fly balloons.
No more full moons, only hot air.
Right. So what makes a hot air balloon fly? Well, what you have to do is you have to heat up the air inside the balloon's envelope to the point that you drive the weight of air, you know, expanding the balloon, the air will expand when it's heated, and you have to drive enough molecules out of that balloon that the weight of the air you drive out of the envelope has to equal the gross weight of the balloon and its passengers. Now, the balloon that we flew had a gross weight of about 1,200 pounds. The canopy was 300 or 400 pounds, the actual fabric. The basket with the propane tanks in it was another couple of hundred pounds. And then, of course, there was passengers. And this balloon could carry up to 3 people on a cool day. Now, so what you had to do, this balloon had a volume of 77,000 cubic feet. So you had to heat that volume of air up to the point that you drove out 1,200 pounds of air. So that begs the question, how hot do you have to raise the temperature of that air before you drive out 1,200 pounds of heated air? And it turns out...
I don't know.
Yeah, it turns out that there's a temperature sensor at the top of the balloon that there's a gauge in the basket of the balloon, so you can tell what the temperature of the air in the top of the balloon is. And in order to lift off, we usually had to raise the temperature at the top of the balloon up near 180 to 200 degrees Fahrenheit.
That's hot.
So at the top of the balloon, it was almost hot enough to boil water.
Wow. Okay. So the material that the balloons are made of, it has to be able to withstand fairly high temperatures. It has to be fairly durable, right?
Right.
What kind of
nylon?
It's nylon. Okay.
Nylon ripstop. And it is redlined, or you never exceed 250 degrees Fahrenheit. At that point, you start to damage the fabric. And the other thing about temperature is the cooler it is, the less less rise of temperature. In other words, if the surrounding air is colder,
right,
then you don't have to heat up the air inside the balloon as much to drive out that same weight of air. But if it's too cold, the vapor pressure of the propane in your tanks is not high enough, and it doesn't have sufficient pressure to drive the gas out of the tanks and up to the burner at a sufficient rate to produce the heat you need. And you need to heat up a lot of air in a hurry. So now let's go through the controls in the balloon. Because it's amazing how much control you have over a balloon. A lot of people say, well, you just go up in the balloon and wherever the wind takes you, that's where you go. And that's not true. You have more control than you'd imagine. You are taken where the wind blows you, but you have some control about what direction the wind is blowing. In the northern hemisphere, the wind veers as it goes up. So if the wind is blowing in a given direction, the wind will rotate to the right or clockwise as you gain altitude. This is called veering. Coming down, you call it backing. But at any rate, if you want to turn to the right, if you want to change your track to the right, you go higher. If you want to turn to the left, you go lower. This is in the northern hemisphere. Southern hemisphere, it's the opposite. But this has to do with the rotation of the Earth and the prevailing winds in the northern hemisphere. So when you're close to the ground, if you're going in a given direction and you want to go to the right of that, you go up in altitude. If you're up at altitude, you want to go to the left, you go down and you'll start tracking to the left. So on a particular morning, you would have a V that you could fly anywhere in there by changing altitude. And sometimes that would be as wide as 90 degrees, sometimes wider. So what would we do before we took off is we would put up what was called a piebald, which was short for pilot balloon. And all a piebald was is we'd get a little balloon. We usually bought the black balloons from a dime store. That's all, just an ordinary little, balloon about the, a little bigger than your head. And we have a tank of helium, and we'd fill up that little kid's balloon with helium, and then we would release it, and we would both time it, and we'd use a sighting compass, And we would track the balloon. And as it would go up, it would go and it would start going, you know, with the surface wind. And then it would veer to the left as it went up. And we'd measure the angle that it was going from us and time it, because you had a table and you could guess what the altitude of the balloon was by how long it had gone up. And so you could figure out what the upper winds were doing in your immediate vicinity. Now, what you would do is, after you knew that you had this wedge of air that you could fly anywhere in, is you would then try and pick a takeoff location that your intended landing area was in the wedge. So you could, if you were good, pick an area to take off in and predict with some accuracy your landing spot. And by the time I had my license, I got to the point that I would pick takeoff locations, different ones. I had different places, school grounds and playgrounds and things that were open areas. And I would take off in those, and I would always land at the Langley Airport. So, you know, with practice, you have very good control of, you know, where you're going to land. Now, let me go back to heating up all this hot air. A typical furnace in a home will produce what's called 500,000 or 500,000 British thermal units, BTUs. That's the, in North America, that's usually how they're rated. So a 500,000 BTU furnace would heat up the average house in a reasonable length of time, over minutes. Now, in a hot air balloon, in my balloon, I wanted to heat up 77,000 cubic feet, which is the volume of several rooms in a normal house. And I want to be able to raise the temperature of that air 5 or 10 degrees Fahrenheit in a matter of 20 or 30 seconds. Think about that. You know, what if you could raise the temperature of three rooms in your house 5 or 10 degrees Fahrenheit in 30 seconds?
I would be a very happy girl in the winter. Oh, yes.
Oh, yes. Well, think about how big a furnace you would need in order to do that.
Yeah, huge.
Huge. So what they do is they have a very special burner in these hot air balloons. And, you know, your charcoal barbecue grill takes the gas off of the top of a propane tank, and that's what it burns. But in a hot air balloon, we have a special siphon or a special little hose that goes right to the bottom of the tank. And we don't take the gas off of the top of the propane. We take the liquid propane. And the pressure in the tank drives the liquid propane up into the special burner, and it goes in a coil that's around the flame, and it is preheated there, and then it comes out of special nozzles, and they're fairly large nozzles, and spray that preheated propane out into the air, and it vaporizes very suddenly, and that releases far more energy than the typical propane flame. So there's liquid driven up to the burner.
Right.
The burner on my balloon, and my balloon was a relatively small balloon. The ones that take up 6 and 8 passengers are much larger. But the burner on my balloon could produce 18 million BTUs. 18 million. All right?
Yeah.
And you could feel the heat from the thing when you were standing below it, the radiant heat coming down. I mean, most of the heat, of course, was going right up into the balloon. But it would produce 18 million BTUs. Now, there's a lever on the burner that you press, and this burner comes on. There's a pilot light. This thing comes on and releases all this energy in a very short burst. And by the way, that's the way you control the altitude, is you give little short bursts. You pull this lever, and you burn for maybe 5 or 10 seconds, and then you release and let that heat rise to the top of the balloon. And when you do a burn, it takes 20 to 30 seconds for the balloon to respond. So one of the really neat things, or at least I thought it was neat, about flying a balloon is you have to really plan ahead. Airplanes and gliders react almost instantly to your control inputs. Balloons are very slow to react, which means as a pilot, you have to really plan ahead. So you're constantly scanning ahead, and if you're flying low, you want to make sure there are no power lines or anything that you're going to be descending below and need to go back up again. And when you're picking out a landing area, you want to be sure there are no power lines or any cables or anything in the area, because you can't suddenly change your mind at the last second. You have to plan ahead. So to go up, you hit the burner. If you want to come down faster, you pull on a rope and it opens a vent in the side of the balloon, and that lets out some of the hot air. And again, it takes time to respond. And then finally, when you're coming in for a landing, my balloon had what was called a rip top. And right at the top of the balloon, the top of the balloon was held in by Velcro. And there was a special cable coming down, and then there was a big piece of webbing that was red, connected to the top of the balloon. And it was red for a reason. You don't pull that unless you want to come down and stay down. So just as you're coming in for a landing, just before you hit the ground, you rip out the top of the balloon, and this opens a great big hole right in the center of the balloon and lets all the hot air out, and then the envelope
will collapse.
Slowly descends to the ground and collapses. It takes minutes for all the hot air to come out of it.
Because we're talking about how many cubic feet of...
70, my balloon was 77,000 cubic feet.
Yeah, and, so that's not going to come out all at once.
Right. I sent you a picture of my balloon. You can pop that up anytime you would like.
Okay.
And now mine had a rip top. There it is. That was my balloon. Sunburst, we called it, because of the colors. And I flew it for about 5 years and had a wonderful time.
It looks beautiful. It looks like it would be a lot of fun to fly.
It was. Now, like I say, it was a relatively small balloon. It would carry 3 people on a cool summer day. If it was a real hot day, then 2 people. Because if you put 3 people in a hot day, you had to heat the top of the balloon up too high. You had to be up around 220 degrees,
that's getting too close for it to the limit of the material, right?
And it shortens the life of your envelope. So the hotter you run it, the sooner it becomes a giant rag.
What's the average lifespan for a balloon? How long does one last if you take care of it, I guess?
Perfect question. Typically, a balloon, which the envelope alone costs anywhere from $30,000 to $60,000, new. Mine was not new when I bought it. Thanks to Keith Allen, he gave me a deal that I couldn't refuse. I flew his balloon for several years, and then I called him up the next year and said, "Hey, Keith, I want to come down and keep flying the balloon." He said, "No, you don't want to come down and keep flying it. You want to fly up there in British Columbia." He said, "Because I'm going to sell it to you at a price you can't refuse." And he was right. And he sold it to me at a price I couldn't refuse, and it was a real bargain. And he was getting ready to retire and sold off most of his toys. But at any rate, a envelope, a brand new one, will cost anywhere from $20,000 to $60,000, depending on the size. Some of the really big ones are even more than that. And they have a typical life of 1,000 to 1,500 hours. So if you take that, let's take a $30,000 balloon and say that it becomes a giant rag at 1,000 hours, you're paying $30 an hour just for the envelope. Forget the propane, forget the, any of the rest. And by the way, most of these bigger balloons that they give rides in and stuff are much more costly than that. They might be $60,000, $80,000, $100,000 for the envelope. So, but at the end of 1,000 hours, like I say, you have a giant 300 or 400 pound rag. So on top of that, you have to replace the hoses that carry the propane up to the burners on a regular basis. You have to replace all the O-rings and rubber seals that are in the burner and the valving. You have to do maintenance on the vents in the burners. And so when you're all done, $100 an hour is bare minimum. Cost of your propane will be anywhere from $50 to $60 a flight just for fuel. And then on top of that, you've got to have a van with a trailer, preferably an enclosed trailer. And you've got to have a chase crew. Now, I was an amateur balloonist. I didn't ever work commercially. And so I used to invite my friends who were aviation nuts to go along and be my chase crew. And about every third flight, they would get to go in the basket with me. In other words, two or three of them would be in the van chasing us on the ground. And by the way, being in a chase crew is fun. And they would chase us on the ground and, you know, go to the landing spot and be ready to catch the basket as we came in. But every third or fourth flight, they would get to be the one that went with me in the hot air balloon. So that's the way I got crew, was to give away rides in the balloon.
Sounds fair enough. Yeah.
You know. So now let me tell you a few other things about hot air balloons that I think are interesting. One of them, I used to land regularly at an airport. So there'd be air traffic. You know, there'd be airplanes coming in there. So the question is, who has the right-of-way? And the hot air balloon has the right-of-way. It has right-of-way over everything because it's the least maneuverable. The next thing up is gliders, and the next thing up is airplanes and helicopters. Airplanes and helicopters have equal right-of-way, but gliders have right-of-way over helicopters and airplanes. Hot air balloons have right-of-way over all the other air traffic. Even including a blimp. So, any rate, I'll tell you a story that I always enjoyed. When I did my first solo flight in Keith's hot air balloon, this is when I was still flying in the U.S., Keith had always wanted to land the balloon back on the airport, but had never been able to get the right winds and the right conditions. And so the day I went for my first solo flight, I picked out a field that I thought would get me somewhere back near the airport.
Because you weren't quite accurate enough yet with your solo flight to know exactly where you're going to land.
First solo flight. First time I went up in the balloon without Keith alone. Well, I got really, really lucky. And as I was going along, and he's on a radio in the chase van down on the ground, and I radioed him, and I said, Keith, I think I'm going to make the airport. Oh, all right. So he says, where on the airport are you going to land? You know, and so he says, I want an exact target. He wasn't going to let me get away with crowing about landing on the airport. So I said, well, I'm going to land next to the main taxiway, between the taxiway and the runway. And I managed to get the balloon down on my first solo flight exactly. It was more luck than skill. And Keith kind of never let me forget it and said, you were lucky. And because he had been trying to do that for years. But at any rate, we always had a lot of fun over that. Now, let me tell you what balloonists do for fun and contests.
There's something more than just flying hot air balloons that's fun.
Yeah, you have to have some kind of way to compete in a balloon. So the way you do it is you have what's called a hound and a hare contest.
Oh, okay.
So what they do is they launch one balloon, and he is the hare, all right?
Okay.
And he goes out, and he goes up and down and, you know, all over the place, and then he finally picks out a nice place to land, and he goes in and lands, and he puts out a marker right where he landed, and then all the hounds, all the other hot air balloons that launched after him, and they have to wait a certain length of time, they have to land as close to where the hare landed, and whoever lands the closest wins. So that's a hound and hare contest. And there are other ones. By the way, at some of the big ones, like down in Phoenix and stuff, they will put a set of keys to a new car on top of a telephone pole in the middle of an open field. Now, this telephone pole is just that, a telephone pole, no wires on it. But they'll put the keys on top of the telephone pole with a cherry picker or something. And then the balloons all try and come in there and grab the keys off of the top of the telephone pole. And if you get the keys, you get to keep the car. It's very, very difficult. And in most times, most contests, nobody wins the car. But but it has been done. So, you know.
It's a test of skill and accuracy. And
very high skill and accuracy. Absolutely.
Somebody in the chat room says, I'd get a fishing pole and a magnet.
There you go.
Is that, would something like that be considered cheating?
Now, maybe. Now, you have to remember that ballooning, hot air ballooning specifically, was the first way that human beings got off the ground. You know, it goes back to France, and they had a hot air balloon. What was funny is they caught the smoke from a fire, and they saw smoke rising, and they thought it was the smoke that made the balloon lift off rather than the heat. But at any rate, that was the way they did. Now, quite often, going back to those early balloon days, you would land in a farmer's field. And, of course, farmers, some of them would get upset with this strange device, you know, coming out of the sky and landing in their field. And so balloonists, going all the way back to the 1700s, when the first balloonists went up, always carried a bottle of champagne.
Uh-huh.
And that was for the farmer. So when you landed, you cracked open the champagne and offered a drink to the farmer. This was your peace offering.
Have a drink.
For trespassing on his property.
And smashing his crops or landing on a cow.
And that is still a absolutely followed tradition to this day, that when you land your hot air balloon in the farmer's field, by the way, I'm a cheapskate. That's why I always try to land on the airport.
That's funny.
But if you land in a farmer's field, you bring along a bottle of champagne and some glasses. And some of them have elaborate cases to carry this, because landing in a balloon sometimes is rough. And so they have these padded cases to carry their bottle of champagne and their wine glass. You know,
it does, sound so very civilized, though. You land in your hot air balloon and break out the champagne out of the special carrying case. I don't know. I grew up out in the country, and I remember hot air balloons landing in our field. I don't remember the champagne, but then again, I was just a child, so maybe I was not allowed. I don't recall any niceties like that, but that doesn't mean anything.
It's an absolute tradition and a must. Now, the other thing, that when you get your pilot's license, you must be able to recite the balloonist's prayer. Now, there's not one balloonist prayer. There are multiple balloonists.
Just pick your favorite.
Right. And I'm gonna recite one that's recited just before taking off. There are others that are recited upon landing. But I'll never forget, the guy who gave me my test said, you have to be able to recite from memory of the balloonist prayer, or you won't get your license. So here's one that is appropriate just before weighing off. And by the way, that's what they call launching the balloon, is weighing off. May the winds be gentle, the stars be bright. May the pilot be skilled and the landing light. May the crew be timely and the recovery easy. So way off. There's all kinds of romance and traditions and so forth that go with hot air balloons. Let me just say one more thing. If you want to go up in a hot air balloon, please do check out the history of the company or people that are taking you up in the hot air balloon.
Yes.
I found there to be a very wide range of skills. Some of the hot air balloonists I met were really outstanding pilots. It requires a great deal of judgment and a great deal of planning ahead. And you must not go unless there are very, very light winds. I preferred less than 5 knots of wind.
Has there ever been a time that you've had a close call? I mean, what would a close call in hot air ballooning be also?
Well, remember, you're dealing with propane and gas. I have not had any close calls in
the hot air
balloon.
You're a safe pilot, generally.
Because I'm very conservative, and I never flew in high winds at all. But there have been some accidents. There was one dreadful accident here in the Lower Mainland near Vancouver a few years ago, in which there were eight people in the balloon. And they were ready to launch the balloon. It was still tethered to the truck, and they had inflated it, and all the people were on board. And suddenly, one of the hoses ruptured, and propane sprayed, you know, all over the place and ignited from the pilot light. And all the people but two jumped out. Some were singed, but not badly hurt. But a woman and her daughter did not jump out in time. There's one woman jumped out after the balloon was 30 feet high and broke her ankles.
So the balloon is rising. There's propane spraying out, and it's catching on fire.
The truth of the matter is, the pilot in this case was the first one out, but he said he was blown out. Some of us questioned that. But anyway, the balloon broke loose, burned the cable, and lifted off with the two people in it.
Who would have no idea what to do.
And unfortunately, they were burned to death.
Is it mostly an equipment failure kind of thing in terms of things going wrong with hot air balloons, as opposed to flying too high and air cooling and
To be fair, most accidents in the air of any kind, flying, airplanes, gliders, hot air balloons, overwhelmingly it's judgment and pilot error that causes the accidents. Rather than equipment failure. But I never did hear all the details of this accident. There was speculation about how recently those hoses had been inspected, how old they were, et cetera. But let me put it this way. I always kept very, very recent new hoses in my balloon because I could see that would be a weak point in the balloon.
Yeah. So like you said, it's a good idea to make sure if you're going ballooning, you're going with a very legitimate company or pilot who
takes good myself care of in trouble, but the balloonists that I knew that were very highly skilled were what I call generic pilots. Like the one that I took lessons from, the company that I took lessons from here in Vancouver when I moved to Canada, moved my flying from Bayview to Canada. And the guy I took lessons from in Bayview, these guys were commercial airline pilots, and they were what I call generic pilots. In other words, they had all kinds of aviation experiences. They didn't just fly balloons. And those are the people that I think make the best and the safest pilots, because they have very broad experience in a lot of different kind of aircraft, weather, et cetera. And have had enough experience to be very conservative in when they fly their hot air balloons. And also, if they're making their living some other way, they don't feel that they have to fly that day, even if the wind is too high. And so all I'm saying is choose the people you fly with very carefully.
Yes. I think that's good advice to end the show on.
Yep. Now, next week, the title of our show is going to be Landing on Water, Flying Float Planes.
Oh, fun.
Yeah.
So the your story from earlier in the show dealing with whether or not to wear a safety vest in a float plane. It's very timely. Right. Very timely.
We always carried them in our plane and wore them, but everyone was heavily briefed. Don't inflate this thing till you're out of the plane.
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing much more about landing on water next week.
Right.
That'll be great. How can people get in touch with you, Ray?
They can write me at ray@twit.tv. So that's RAY@TWIT.TV.
Fantastic.
And I look forward to your emails and suggestions for future shows and questions. Don't hesitate to drop me a line.
And if anyone is interested in downloading past episodes of Maxwell's House, you can go to twit.tv/MH and download any old episode. They've been through so many topics on this show related to aviation. It's been quite a ride. And additionally, you can subscribe to the podcast through iTunes if that's what you choose. It's all over the place, this Maxwell's House. It's the house that flies everywhere.
Let me make one other announcement. I have been getting a lot of email, people saying, you know, in your early podcast, you talked about a whole lot of other topics. And one of the topics that people miss is my talking about color science and digital photography. I am now going to be a regular guest on another show called This Week in Photography.
Oh, fun.
So if you've missed the color science and digital photography, by all means, tune in to This Week in Photography. I will be appearing there in the next week or two, and I'll be answering questions about color science and digital photography, which is another one of my interests.
Great. That's excellent. I'm glad people will have a chance to be able to hear from you there, because that was definitely a popular topic and something that was really interesting as well. So awesome. More Maxwell. More Ray Maxwell. And that does it for another episode of Maxwell's House. Closing the doors on episode 75. I'm Dr. Kiki, and I've enjoyed talking with Ray Maxwell today about hot air balloons. I hope that you all didn't think it was a bunch of hot air. Until next time.